Hi, my name is June. I'm an alcoholic. Hi. I couldn't help but thinking while Marie was introducing me in my early years of sobriety, after hearing an introduction like that, I would purposely not like that speaker. I'd just wait for him. I know I wasn't going to like him, especially if they were wearing pink. I didn't wear anything pink until I was over 10 years sober. I didn't allow anything pink in my home. I talked at a meeting in Easter Sunday a couple of years ago, local to where I live in Santa Monica. And after the meeting, this guy came up to thank me, primarily because his sponsor made him. You know how you can tell. And this guy said to me, he said, I'd like to thank you. He said, I thought that was a very good story. He said, I don't believe it was your story, but I liked the way that you told it. And I thought, you know, only in Alcoholics Anonymous could we be so paranoid as to sit there and think that people get up here and make things up to tell, you know. And I thought later, I thought, you know, if that guy had seen me when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, he would have believed my story. There wouldn't have been any question in his mind. But it's sort of funny that Alcoholics Anonymous has made me into a person where now a lot of people don't believe that my story is the one that I really lived. I really want to thank you very much for inviting me. I guess down here is the proper way to say that. I've had a wonderful time. I talked to my boyfriend, and I was telling him tonight that most of you talk funny, but the message is the same. And it's funny, you know, sometimes I've gone to so many meetings in California, in Los Angeles, where I got sober, and sometimes, you know, I almost forget that there are people who are sober outside of Los Angeles. You know, I mean, I just think we just go to lots and lots of meetings, and AA is just great, and then all of a sudden you come here and look at all of you. You guys, I bet a lot of you never even been to my home group. And it's just amazing, you know, and listening today, listening to Gracie and to Bob and everything, you know, and I spent some of the day with Gloria, and those are a bunch of accents right there, but I heard every one of them saying something that some of the old timers in my area have said to me, or I've heard them say, and it's just so neat. It's the Alcoholics Anonymous is so special. And then Daisy's here, and I got just a second just to talk with her and find out a little bit about how Alcoholics Anonymous is working somewhere else. And I think Alcoholics Anonymous is an incredible program. It has given me a life that I never would have wanted, and it's made me a person that I never wanted to be. And it's sort of interesting that I can tell you that I'm happier than I've ever been living this kind of life that I wanted no part of when I first came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. I love AA and I love to be sober, like a friend of mine back home says, but I don't like everyone in Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a guy in Texas and he got up and this is my favorite line, and he said, if you like everyone in AA, you're not going to enough meetings. But I think we have something very, very special here. And I was talking with Sue today, and I was telling her about, you know, sometimes when you stay in Alcoholics Anonymous, even those people that I didn't particularly like when I came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, those who have stayed have become more and more important in the years that I have stayed, primarily because they've stayed. And I'm so grateful to the old-timers and the people who have come ahead of me. And I'm very grateful to those people who've come after me. And I have lessons that I've needed to learn from all of you. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous, I guess, seems more and more special to me the more that I realize how many people have touched my life and changed it and will never know it. I don't know their name. I can't remember what city they're from. I just remember sitting somewhere, maybe over somebody's house, like Hollis was talking about, listening to a tape and hearing them share some little story. And it had an effect on my life that kept me sober at that point and at that time. You know, there's an awful lot of hope in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And those people who have gone before me are usually the ones that have given me that hope. Because they've been through any kind of experiences, the good, the bad, and the ugly, and they've stayed sober through them. And that for me has always been the hope in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to tell you a little bit about what I used to be like, because I don't think a lot of my story makes much sense without telling you that. But first of all, for those of you who are new or might be visiting, I want you to know I'm not an authority on alcoholism. I'm not an expert on alcoholism. I'm not authority or an expert on Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm just going to tell you a little bit about how it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now, and share a little of my experience, strength, and hope. I also want you to know that I'm not paid to get up here and tell you my story. I know when I'm done, you're going to think, thank God they didn't have to pay her for that, but it's important to me. It's important to me that Alcoholics Anonymous is free, that it was free when I came here, because God knows I never could have come if it wasn't, and I never could have stayed if it hadn't remained so. I'm one of those people who believes I was born an alcoholic. I don't want to have a philosophical discussion with anybody about that after the meeting. It's just something that I believe. I believe that because there was something wrong with me before I ever started to drink. The first obsession that I had in life was suicide. The earliest memories that I have go back to the age of about 5 years old. And at the time that I was 5 years old, I began to try and kill myself on a regular basis. I began to cut my hands and fingers and wrists with razor blades. I began to take overdoses of baby aspirin, which was all I knew about at the time. I used to beat my face and body with a hammer. And when my mother would leave me alone in the car while she was in there drinking, I would take the cigarette lighter and I would burn my body in as many places as I possibly could. Now, I know there's not a whole lot of you people in here who are going to identify with that. But it happens to be part of my story, and those are the earliest memories that I have. I do not believe that there was a day that went by before I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that I didn't try and take my own life, put myself in a position where someone else was likely to take my life, or pray to a God that I was very slowly losing faith in to please let me die. It was my number one out. It was the thing that I wanted the most. Obviously, I was not very successful at suicide. And so for someone like me, I'm very grateful that I found alcohol and chemicals when I did. And when I'm asked to share in Alcoholics Anonymous, I talk about the fact that I used chemicals. I don't talk about them because I want to impress you that I was a cool dope fiend, because I was never a cool dope fiend. I talk about the fact that I took chemicals because it's part of my experience. And, you know, when I first came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, there were some people in meetings, and they would say, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous is for pure alcoholics. And they'd get very upset about the fact that anybody might mention that they'd taken anything with what they drank. And I used to worry about it a lot. I later found out that really the only people who mind you talking about the fact that you took something with your alcohol are the people in AA who are still taking those things. So I don't worry about it anymore. When I was 7 years old, I was introduced to drugs. By the time I was 8, I began to drink on a regular basis. By the time I was 9, I found a combination that I was never to alter in any way because it worked. I found barbiturates, or sleeping pills, or downers, whatever you might know them as, and alcohol. And the combined effect of those chemicals with alcohol got me exactly where I wanted to go. I was not a party girl. I was never a social drinker. I didn't drink so that I could feel good. And again, I know many of you are not going to identify with that. I know y'all had a lot, some of you had a lot of fun out there with your drinking. But that was not the how and the why of it for me. I didn't drink to feel good. I drank so I didn't have to feel anything at all. And that was the how and the why of it for me. And in between those times when I was drinking and taking those chemicals, I was trying to kill myself as often as I possibly could, as often as I could get enough pills to try and do it. And that really was the thing that I wanted the most. You know, it just always seemed to hurt too much for me. And I really believe that had I not found alcohol when I did, that I would have had to have been locked up in some kind of an institution. And that's why I'm grateful that I found it, because it could take the pain away so that it didn't matter for hours or maybe sometimes even days at a time. And I needed that desperately. I grew up in an alcoholic home. I knew all about alcoholism firsthand. My mother was an alcoholic. My mother was a bar drinker. There was a lot of violence in my home. There was a lot of broken promises in my home. There were a lot of any of the things that go on in anyone else's alcoholic home. And I knew about this right away from the very beginning. And I knew I wanted no part of it. I certainly never saw alcoholism as a disease. I saw it simply as a weakness that my mother had. But I was not going to have any part of it. When I was a little kid and they asked me what I wanted to be when I grew up, I said a boy. They told me that I couldn't because it wasn't as easy to do back then as it is today. But this was something that bothered my family a lot. I was taken to priests. I was taken to psychiatrists and psychologists. I cannot give you a diagnosis of what those psychiatrists or psychologists thought about my condition or the type of personality that I was. Because like my friend Patty back home says, I never told those people anything. I always thought they should have to work for their money. And I would just sit there for the designated period of time and I would stare at them, but they never got any information out of me. Part of the reason that I wanted to be a boy had to do with the way that I saw the world. And I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous time and time again that the way I saw the world is not necessarily the way that the world was, but it's the way that I saw it. And when I was growing up, before coming into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I do not ever remember seeing a man cry. In fact, to the best of my recollection, I do not ever remember seeing a man show any emotion with the exception of one. That was anger and rage. Many times it led to violence, but that was the only emotion I ever saw a man seemingly experience. And on the other hand, although the women in my life reacted with anger and violence and rage, I saw that some of them felt pain. I saw some of them cry. I even saw a few of them have nervous breakdowns. And these women were going through exactly the same experiences that the men in their lives were going through, seemingly feeling nothing. And I looked at those two different groups of people and I decided immediately which one I wanted to be like. And I spent my life before coming into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and for some time afterwards trying to be what I thought a man was. And it was someone who cared about no one, who felt absolutely nothing, and if they did feel anything, never let anyone know it. Now, I'm the kind of person that, had it not been for alcohol, could never have done that. I'm one of those people that Clancy talks about that seem to have been born without any insulation at all for my emotions. I seem to feel things 100 times more than anyone else around me. If I wanted to think about it tonight, I can tell you when I was 5 and 6 years old and I went to school and the kids used to tease me about having curly red hair and being tall and being skinny and all the things that they probably teased many of you about. If I wanted to think about it tonight, I could tell you who they were, what they were wearing, what they called me. And I can remember the feelings if I really wanted to concentrate on that. Fortunately, I've been sober long enough that I don't have time to waste on doing that dumb stuff, but I used to do it a lot. Anyway, and I was just that kind of a person. And when I found that out about myself at 5 and 6 years old, that these people that I didn't even care about, that I didn't even know, that they could hurt me that much, that they could make me want to cry and sometimes even cry, I found out at the age of 5 and 6 years old that I was the thing that I hated the most in the entire world. I was weak. And in my life, there's never been anything that I could tolerate less in anyone, most of all myself, than those things that I had decided were weaknesses. And those are some of the greatest old ideas that I've had to work on in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, are what I have considered weaknesses and how I see myself and what those things are. Anyway, and at that time, that was what I had decided, and that for me, I believe, is what a lot of the self-hatred was that I experienced and why the suicide attempts. I can't tell you honestly that I drank out there until I lost my self-respect and I lost my self-worth. I have to tell you that honestly, I don't believe I ever had either one of those qualities to any degree at all until long after I was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. I cannot remember ever in my life, looking back on it, liking anything about myself. I never liked the way I looked. I never liked where I was living. I never liked what was going on in my life. And most of all, I never, for one instant, liked the way that I was feeling. And that's why for someone like me, I desperately needed to find alcohol and the chemicals that I did. When I was a little bit older, I finally accepted the fact somehow that I was not going to be able to be a boy. And so I had to settle for the next best thing. And the way that I saw the world, I'm from a little beach town in Los Angeles called Venice. The way that I saw the world in Venice, there was really only one alternative, and that was to be a tough broad. And I spent all my time before coming into Alcoholics Anonymous trying to be what I thought a tough broad was. Now, I'll bet that tough broads in Venice are probably different than tough broads here in Hilton's Head, but we had our certain requirements, and they were mandatory. First of all, you had to be in a gang, and I was. You had to do a lot of fighting, and I did. I've never won a fight in my life. However, I never fought less than from 5 to 15 people at a time. I learned after coming into Alcoholics Anonymous that the reason I always fought groups of from 5 to 15 was that way if you lose, no one can challenge whether you're really tough or not, because no one would expect you to possibly be able to defend yourself against that many people. On the other hand, if you fight with one person and you lose, it could affect your entire reputation as a fighter. So I was one of those people that was willing to walk around with my face bashed in a lot on the off chance that someone out there might think I must be pretty tough. And that's sort of how I got by out there. I used to stand around on the beach, and we were always barefoot. And being a beach town, that was a requirement for tough broads, at least in my gang. And I would stand down there on the sidewalk in Venice with my cigarette and my gang looking tough. I had practiced. I don't know about them. Sometimes as the touristy-looking people were walking by, I would look them right in the eye. I would take my cigarette. I would throw it down on the sidewalk, and I would put it out with my bare feet. And these touristy-looking people would sort of poke one another and whisper back and forth. And I knew what they were saying. They were saying, "Wow, that is one tough broad." And I was very impressed that I could do this. I was sure that they would be impressed, too. Of course, just being able to step on lit cigarette butts did not really mean you were tough. You were only truly tough if you were then able to walk upon those feet as if it did not hurt. And those are the kind of things that were important to me before I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. My sponsor convinced me after I'd gotten here that perhaps what some of those people were saying to one another after watching me put cigarette butts out with my bare feet was, "Did you see that? That person just put flesh to fire. Why would anybody do anything so stupid?" But I thought it was a very tough thing to do, and so I did it all the time. In the years that I've been sober, tattoos have become very popular for women, at least out in Los Angeles. And many of my friends, some in AA and some before, have gotten tattoos. Most of them have things like canned beer or a flower or a butterfly in sort of a little secret kind of cute place or something. And I've always been grateful that tattoos were not popular when I was on the street. Because if they were, I'd be standing up here tonight and I'd have a shark on my arm. And it would swim whenever I did this. And I would have gotten something like a battleship on my chest, or maybe a canoe in my case, but if I had thought that it would impress you that I was tough, I have no doubt in my mind that I would have done it. The last time that I got beat up, I was in my apartment with my mother, and my gang came by, and they knocked on the door, and they said, "If you come out of the house today, we're going to beat you up." And so I immediately got dressed and left the house, because I couldn't have anyone anywhere think that I was afraid of anything. I refused to recognize fear. It talks about in the book, you know, that there are healthy fears that we learn to recognize, you know, what they are and things like that. But I didn't even have that. I just refused to recognize those kind of feelings. And so instead I got dressed and I left the house because I didn't want anyone anywhere to ever think I was afraid of anything. And I came outside, and as I walked down the street, they started to follow me. And I thought, you know, I can either walk down this street or I can take the alley. And I knew if I didn't take the alley, they'd think it was because I was too afraid to take the alley. And I didn't want anyone to think I was afraid to do anything, and so I took the alley, and they beat me up. And while I was laying in the alley, and they were knocking my head against the pavement on the street, all they wanted that day, and I don't know why that was what they wanted, but all they wanted was for me to cry. And I didn't cry. I don't know how long they hit me before they got bored and they walked away. But I didn't cry. And when I got up from that fight with my black eye and my swollen lip and the blood running down my face, at that point in time in my life, if you'd asked me, I'd have told you I won. Because I didn't cry. I didn't give them what they wanted. And at that point in time, that was the most important thing I could possibly imagine, was not to let anyone think that they could make me have any kind of an emotional reaction. It was just that important to me. And of course, tonight, if somebody walked up to me and said, "Look, I'll tell you what, June, I'm either going to punch you in the face a few times or you can cry a few tears," I'd cry a few tears. I mean, what's the big deal, you know? But it just wasn't quite like that then. I was brought to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous by my mother. My mother had been in and out of the program for a number of years at that time with varying lengths of sobriety. She brought me to the meeting not because I wanted help, not because I needed this program, not because even she thought I needed this program, simply because she was afraid to leave me alone in the apartment. She thought I'd get her evicted again. And I walked into the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the miracle of this program began for me that night, even though that was not the date that I was to get sober. And it began because there was a man in that meeting that I admired more than anybody else in the entire world. And I didn't admire a whole lot of people. I had very high standards. Again, many of you are not going to identify with my standards, but they were mine, and I stood by them. And I saw Paul. I admired Paul because he'd been in prison, because he had tattoos, because he rode a motorcycle, because he was from my hometown, because he carried a knife and had it with him at the meeting that night, because he was one of the most hostile and violent men that I knew in Venice. And I looked at him and I thought, wow, I just never thought people this great came to AA. I thought it was just for weak people like my mother. You know, if I had to tell you what I wanted in one sentence or less out of life when I came into this program, this is sort of what I wanted all my life. I wanted the ability to walk into rooms full of strangers and have everyone there back away from me in terror. Now, when you're 87 pounds, that almost never happens. But that was what I wanted. And this guy, Paul, was the kind of guy that I had seen walk into parties and walk into bars in Venice. And I'd seen tables get up and let him have that table if he wanted it. Because he was that crazy when he was drinking that they didn't know what he was going to do. And I just couldn't believe that anybody this wonderful would come to AA, you know. He'd achieved everything I wanted in life. And it made a big impression on me. I got drunk the next night, and then I came back to some meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I spent about 2 weeks going to lots and lots of meetings. I never raised my hand because I didn't have a problem. But I spent my time talking to Paul, and Paul was getting sober at that time. He, too, had been in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous for many years, like my mother. He was going to meetings at that time. He was sober. And he took me to lots and lots of meetings because he was so new in the program. And in between the meetings, I spent all my time trying to convince Paul that I wasn't an alcoholic. I later found out that non-alcoholics don't have to spend any time trying to convince people they're not alcoholics. They already know that. But I explained to Paul that I was too young to be an alcoholic, that I couldn't possibly be an alcoholic, that I wasn't anything like my mother, who really was an alcoholic, that I was just too young. I had places to go, people to see, things to do. I had my whole life ahead of me, and I really just could not possibly be an alcoholic. And finally, Paul turned to me and he said, you know, June, pretty new around here, and they tell me I cannot diagnose anybody's disease but my own. He said, but in your case, I'm going to make an exception. I've seen the way that you drink, and I've seen the way that you take chemicals, and I happen to believe if you don't come into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and take what these people have to offer you within a period of 6 months or less, you're going to be out on the streets, you're going to be shooting stuff, and you're going to be selling your ass. And I knew he wasn't trying to scare me. He wasn't trying to make something up like sometimes some of the teachers do in school to try and scare the kids. He was just talking about facts. He was talking about things that had happened in his life. He was talking about things that had happened and were beginning to happen in mine. And I thought a little bit about what he said, but I did not want to join Alcoholics Anonymous. I did not want to join any organization that was allowing my mother to be a member. And during this two-week period of time, as I went to meetings, absolutely every alternative but Alcoholics Anonymous was removed from my life. I was living with my mother at that time. By the time I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, the only person that I hated more than my mother was myself. And the way that I felt about my mother at the time that I lived there, I used to attack her physically. She was sober at this time, and she no longer thought she had to be subjected to those attacks, and she asked me to leave her home, and I did. My family had not spoken to me or allowed me to come into their home under any circumstances for approximately 3 years at that time. I didn't even bother to try and call. I knew I wasn't wanted. I had been in and thrown out of about 6 foster homes at that time. None of them would take me back. I tried to get into some of the drug rehab and alcohol recovery homes that were available in the Los Angeles area at that time. None of them would take me, some because of my age and some just because of my attitude. And then I remember thinking, you know, who needs those people? Who needs this family stuff? You know, who needs any of that thing? The only thing that's really important to any tough broad is your gang. That's all that really matters. And then I told you what happened as I walked down that alley. All 5 members of my own gang beat me up. And so I found myself sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was 87 pounds. I had a black eye. I had a swollen lip. I was barefoot. I had the clothes that I had on. I had no family. I had no friends. I had no money. I had no place to live. I had no place else to go. And I started to raise my hand in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, you can see where it was rather a simple choice. It wasn't like, would you like to go to Hawaii or join AA? It was much easier than that. When I began to raise my hand in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, there were some people in Alcoholics Anonymous at that time who I know today were not aware of the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they came up to me after meetings and they told me that I was too young to be an alcoholic. And that they didn't want a little kid sitting in their meetings while they talked about serious things. And that if I came back to those meetings that they would get together and throw me out, that I just wasn't wanted there. And I certainly didn't know Alcoholics Anonymous had traditions. I certainly didn't know Alcoholics Anonymous had a third tradition that stated the only requirement for AA membership was a desire to stop drinking. I just thought AA didn't want me either. And that was fine with me, because I didn't want me either, and I hadn't for a long, long time. And so I fell back on my number one answer, the answer I'd been using since I was 5 years old. I went over to a friend of my mother's. I went into her bathroom, which is the first place I went at anyone's home I ever visited. I found the kind of pills that I needed, and I took an overdose to kill myself one more time. And before I passed out that day, I went to a noon meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. By the time I got to the meeting, I couldn't stand up. I couldn't sit down. I had to lay in the meeting. And I don't know about out here in Hilton Head, but in Los Angeles, where I got sober, we almost never call on people to participate who are laying in the meeting. But that particular day, for some reason, they called on me. I certainly can't tell you what I said. The next thing I remember is waking up in a hospital, a doctor giving me medication to make me throw up and explaining to me that the pills I had taken were to slow down my heart. And had I been there 5 or 10 minutes later, I would have been in a coma that they probably couldn't have brought me out of. And I really don't know why that was so different than any of the other overdoses that I'd been inflicting upon myself during the years that I was out there. I just know that it was. Because since that time, I haven't taken anything that affects me from the neck up. And that's how I personally define sobriety. I've done that one day at a time. If I continue to do that one day at a time, the 13th of July of this year, I'll celebrate 15 continuous years of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. I think I know what I was trying to say in that meeting that day, no matter how incoherent what I actually said was. I think really all I was trying to say to those people is, you know what? I don't know if I've gone as far as some of you people have. And then again, maybe I've gone just a little bit farther than some of you. But I don't really think that's the point here. Because the point is, I don't have any place left to go. And I don't know if I want what you people have. All I know is I can't stand what I've got anymore. And you don't have to tell me that if I go back out there on the streets, I'm going to die. Because dying doesn't scare me. Not one damn bit. Dying is what I have been trying to do since I was 5 years old. What scares me is maybe I can go out there and live for another 20 or 30 years like some of you people did. And that's what I can't stand. I can't stand living that way anymore. So please let me stay. And the people of Alcoholics Anonymous have let me stay. And that's not to say that there were not still people then, and maybe are not even still people today, who will never believe that I could possibly have been an alcoholic when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous at 13 years old. But that's not really important. What's important for me, and I think for each and every one of us, is that we have a third tradition that states the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. And that means that no one anywhere can ever throw you or anyone else who has that desire out of a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a... I've been very fortunate in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've gotten very active in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've tried to maintain that. I got very active in general service for many years in my sobriety, and I learned a lot about the tradition. And I strongly advise each and every one of you to do that, too, because sort of like Bob was talking about this morning, it's very important for the future of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what I'd like to read you real quick is, for those of you who haven't had a chance yet to read about the third tradition, I'd like to read to you some of the requirements originally or they were thinking about instead of the third tradition. We were resolved to admit nobody to AA but that hypothetical class of people we termed pure alcoholics. Except for their guzzling and the unfortunate results thereof, they could have no other complications. So, beggars, tramps, asylum inmates, prisoners, queers, plain crackpots, and fallen women were definitely out. Yes, sir, we'd cater only to pure and respectable alcoholics. Any others would surely destroy us. Besides, if we took in those odd ones, what would decent people say about us? We built a fine mesh fence right around AA. Now, I don't know about any of you, but if they decided to not keep it simple and to use those requirements, I know I wouldn't be here, and neither would my sponsors and most of the people I've heard share in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I'm real grateful that they kept it simple. In coming into Alcoholics Anonymous, there were still people, and they'd walk up to me and they'd say, you know, kid, I spilt more booze on my tie than you ever drank. And I turned to them and I explained if they hadn't spilt so much, they probably would have gotten sober younger. The longer I'm sober, the more grateful I am for those people who were here when I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because those were the people who tolerated me. We have a lot of different kinds of newcomers that come into Alcoholics Anonymous. A lot of the newcomers are very lovable. I was one of the tolerable kind. I was the one that I was fortunate that there were people who were willing to tolerate me. I'm not so sure I would be as tolerant as many of the people were that to me when I first came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous with a bad attitude. I don't want you to think I got sober and got a bad attitude. That would be misleading. I simply came here with the only attitude I had ever had, and it had always been bad. I did not like women. I did not like me. I did not like my mother. I figured any other women who would be in these meetings were like me or my mother, and I didn't like them. I didn't talk to them. I didn't shake hands with them. I didn't want to sit next to them. I tried not to listen when they talked, which is something that always makes me feel better because I know there's never as many people listening to me out there as it looks like. The only men I had ever known in my life were alcoholics who beat up women, and they scared me, and I didn't want anything to do with them either. Now, I don't know about you guys, but when I got sober 14 and a half years ago in Los Angeles, all we had were men and women. And so I had a problem right away. I had a very limited vocabulary when I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It consisted almost solely of profanity, the exception of a few other words like the and mother. That was it. I found that many people in the program were offended by the use of that kind of language, and I tried to use it more when they were around. I went to meetings and everywhere else barefoot for most of the first 2 years that I was sober. I wore my motorcycle jacket that on the back said, "Do unto others," and then split. I wore motorcycle chains. I smoked 3 packs of cigarettes a day when I got sober, and I lit all of them myself. Occasionally, someone would hold a match, and I allowed them to hold it as long as they liked. But they never lit my cigarette with it. I lit all my own cigarettes. Occasionally, someone would hold a door open for me. I allowed them to hold it until they got tired, and when the door closed, I then opened it for myself only and went through the door. I didn't ask for rides. I either walked. Occasionally, I hitchhiked, took a bus if I had enough money. I didn't want anyone anywhere, especially in Alcoholics Anonymous, to think that I needed them. I wanted you all to know I was just fine all by myself. Of course, I know how funny that is today because nobody who's fine all by themselves ever comes to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, but I thought it was very important for you to not think that I needed you. After I'd been sober a short period of time, I took up smoking cigars and then later on a pipe. And between my appearance, my smoking habits, and my profanity, there were times when I could sit in a meeting, not this large, but a fairly large size, and have an entire row all to myself. I remember one of the Tuesday night meetings that I attended, they made me the greeter. I would stand at the door, barefoot, with my motorcycle chains and cigar, welcoming the newcomers as they came into AA. Sometimes after they'd walk by, I'd hear their sponsor say, "You see, if you keep drinking, you can end up like that." I came into the program, a lot of people's favorite thing to do was to try and guess my age. When I first got sober, they were guessing me at 37. I found a couple of sponsors in Alcoholics Anonymous right away. And you can see right away where I might not have been baby of the year in 72. But I did find these people, and they were the ones that were most important probably for their tolerance. I would go to the Thursday night meeting, and I'd see my sponsor, Gail Wilson. I'd walk up to Gail, and she'd say, "All right, look, June, please don't sit next to me at the meeting tonight. I can't take the cigar smoke." And then as I was walking away, she'd say, "And June, please don't tell anyone that I am your sponsor." And that was fine with me because I really didn't want anyone to know I was hanging out with someone like Gail. I mean, Gail was from the South, and she not only did not use the same language I did, she didn't know what a lot of the words I was using meant. And it was really bad for my image as a tough bride to be seen associating with someone like her. She wore pink at times. It was just bad. So we would meet secretly after meetings and talk about AA. I found a home group right away in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the Monday Night Venice group. And I know a lot of you have not ever been there, but it was a very, very special meeting. It's not the kind of meeting everyone could have gotten sober at. But it's the kind of meeting where someone who was barefoot wearing no shoes and a motorcycle jacket and smoking cigars and chains didn't stand out at all. And so it was perfect. It was home for me. And I became the literature chairperson there, and I never missed that meeting. I was told in Alcoholics Anonymous that it was very important that I get a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And at the Monday Night Venice group, they'd say, Secretary makes the announcement, they say, now we sell that book for exactly what we paid for it. We don't make any money on that book, and we're going to sell it to you for just that exact same amount. If you don't have that kind of money, neither did most of us when we came in here, so we'll make liberal credit arrangements with you after the meeting, including nothing down and nothing a week until you get enough to pay for it. And then at the Venice group, they'd throw in, and if you're too afraid to talk to somebody about it, you just go ahead and steal it. Well, I'd been stealing longer than I'd been drinking. And as far as I was concerned, those were two totally separate activities. I saw no reason to quit stealing because I had quit drinking, and I didn't. But I thought perhaps if I stole from an AA meeting, it could jinx my sobriety. And so instead, I went to the library in Santa Monica, and I stole the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, too. Lots of books. I remember talking to one of my sponsors that night, and I said, hello, Jeff. I said, I stole the big book today. And I thought about this when I gave Jeff his 15-year cake a few years back. Jeff didn't say to me, you know, June, we no longer steal now that we're sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. I remember he said, that's great, kid, you got the book, you know. Because he knew for someone like me it had to start there. If it was important enough to steal it, it was important to me. I went to lots and lots of meetings. I went to 21 meetings a week most of my first 2 years in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had a seventh grade education when I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was both unable and unwilling to go back to school. And so instead I went to lots and lots of meetings, and I got the kind of job that you can get with a seventh grade education. I was allowed to work very flexible hours, sometimes a graveyard shift, sometimes a swing shift, so that I was able to get to that many meetings. And it was a great job for me. I've always wondered why they kept me as long as they did. I was an answering service operator, and if those people were not nice to me, I just hung up on them. You know? Anyway, I think probably some of those years, you know, like Bob talked about this morning, sobriety was not an easy thing for me, especially in the early years. And for me, it had a lot to do with all the feelings that I was starting to feel. I was having to feel all those feelings that I'd been trying to run away from since I was 5 years old, and I didn't know how to deal with those feelings. I was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and a lot of the reasons that I acted the way that I did was because I didn't want you getting near me. I didn't want you coming up and hugging me. I didn't want you sitting next to me. I didn't take showers even after I got sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous for a long time. Some of it had to do with the fact that no one had ever told me how often you were supposed to brush your teeth or take a shower, and I certainly wasn't going to ask, you know. But a lot of it had to do with the fact that I didn't feel like getting that close to myself. You know, I felt like throwing up every time I had to look in a mirror or touch myself to wash myself off. And that had a lot to do with the way that I acted in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I wanted to make sure you didn't get too close for a long time. Some of it had to do with the fact that no one had ever told me how often you were supposed to brush your teeth or take a shower. And I certainly wasn't going to ask, you know. But a lot of it had to do with the fact that I didn't feel like getting that close to myself. You know, I felt like throwing up every time. Long time. Some of it had to do with the fact that no one had ever told me how often you were supposed to brush your teeth or take a shower. And I certainly wasn't going to ask, you know. But a lot of it had to do with the fact that I didn't feel like getting that close to myself. You know, I felt like throwing up every time I had to look in a mirror or touch myself to wash myself off. And that had a lot to do with the way that I acted in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I wanted to make sure you didn't get too close to me and find out just what I was. Because after I got sober for a little while, I started to be very aware of those things that I had done. And I had, during my drinking, I'd been very proud of the people that I had hurt and manipulated and taken advantage of. And suddenly after I got sober, I wasn't so proud of it anymore. It didn't seem like I'd been such a tough Venice bride. It seemed instead that I'd been nothing but a dirty little Venice bride. You know, just that thing. I didn't feel good enough to stand next to anybody or look in anybody's eyes.
And I sat in these meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I listened to so many of the people that would get up and share, and sort of like Bob said today, there wasn't really any time frame, but they would all talk about the fact that they came into Alcoholics Anonymous and they didn't like themselves either. But they went to lots and lots of meetings, and they did what was asked of them here in the program. And somewhere along the line in their life, in their sobriety, they were able to get out there and look people in the eye and walk on the sunny side of the street. And I would sit there in those meetings, and I would think, that will never happen for me. But maybe if I try this thing really hard, maybe someday when I look in a mirror, I won't feel nauseous anymore. And that was the hope for me. There was hope that maybe I could just get that far. I could like June. But maybe I just wouldn't feel nauseous if I looked in a mirror. And that was enough hope to keep me coming to meetings in Alcoholics Anonymous. Active in the program, when I was about 11 months sober, I went to one of my first conventions. It was the International Young People's Conference. It was held in San Francisco at a place called the St. Francis Hotel. I don't know how many of you have ever been there. I have never been back. But I can only tell you the way that I saw it on that particular occasion. First of all, I had grown up, as I said, in Venice, which is a beach town. I had run away once. I had made it 6 miles east to a place called Culver City. That was about as far as I had ever been. So when we drove to San Francisco, this was an 8-hour drive from Los Angeles, and I'd never been that far from home. And we pulled up, and you know, I told you that I grew up in an alcoholic home, so you got to know that a lot of my life I spent living in hotels with my mother. When we pulled up to the St. Francis Hotel, it was not like the hotels that Mom and I used to stay in. I looked inside, and they had these guys who were going to park the car for you. I had never seen that. And inside, there were these long red velvet drapes, and there were these red carpets. And indoors, there were the men, and they were in there wearing suits, and the women had long dresses on, and it was daytime, for Christ's sakes, you know. And I had never seen anything like that in my life. And my friends said, "We're here, we're at the convention," and they were all excited, and they got out, and they were starting to rush into the hotel, and I would not get out of that car. And they said, "Come on, we got to go in there." I'm not going in a place like that. I can't. You know, that's a nice place. That's for nice people. And I knew if I walked through those doors that one of the people from the hotel were going to say, "Excuse me, this is a nice place. This is for respectable people. You're from Venice, aren't you?" I just didn't want to put myself through that, and I didn't want to put my friends through that. And after about 2 hours, they finally convinced me to go in. I snuck into the room. That's how I saw it. And it's the only convention of Alcoholics Anonymous I've ever attended, and I've attended quite a few in the years that I've been sober, that I never went to one meeting. I just stayed in that room hiding, knowing that I wasn't good enough to be in a nice place like that. And that's just a little bit of an idea of how those are the kind of feelings that I was dealing with. I know, too, though, some of the things that Bob talked about today, it had a lot to do with my old ideas and that I hung on to so many of the things about myself and about my old way of life. I just clung to those old ideas. It was all I knew. And so I kept trying to be a tough fraud, and I kept trying to be this person, which is the only person I'd ever strived to be, even after. And so I know that had a lot to do with why the feelings that I had about myself lasted for so long. After I'd been sober, though, for a little while, I got an opportunity to go to business college and learn how to be a secretary. If there's anything in my life I never wanted to be, it was a secretary. I don't know hardly any tough frauds that ever grew up to be secretaries. But my sponsors thought it would be a good idea. I went to this school. I started out typing 17 words a minute with 9 errors. I stayed there and typed one day at a time for 14 months. And at the end of that time, I was typing 37 words a minute with 19 errors. And they told me that I wasn't going to make a secretary. And I thought I could have told them that, you know. But I did okay in the other classes. And so they told me I could probably get an office job if I would take a test to get an equivalent to a high school diploma. And so I studied for this test, and it was on 5 different areas that you learn about in high school if I had ever gone. I took the test. I did okay on the first 4 parts. The 5th part was math. I thought they'd start out with addition and subtraction, which is about all the math that I know to this day. Instead, they started out with algebra and geometry, and then they started to do things I can't even pronounce, let alone do. They had things like a rectangle and then a line drawn across it to make it into 2 triangles, and the question would be, how many feet are in one of those triangles? And so I sat there, I started drawing little pictures of feet in there. I have no better idea tonight than I did then how you're supposed to figure that out. And so I turned to my higher power. I was at the bargain stage of my sobriety. And I said, "Look, God, I'll tell you what I'm going to do here. All the answers on this test are A, B, C, or D. I'm going to go through this test and pick lots of A's, you know, for AA. And I hope you know your math." I hate to be the one to tell you that God's as bad at math as he is at typing. So we somehow managed to pass the test. And now it's time for me to go out and look for a job. And that was very difficult. I didn't know how to... I'd never known any what I call citizen-y type people. You know, and those are people that I considered... they worked Monday through Friday in the daytime. And I had never known any. And I didn't know how to dress like they did. I didn't know how to talk like they did. I just didn't feel like they did. But I did the footwork to go out and look for these jobs. And some of the women in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous helped dress me. You know, they gave me some clothes that they had. They took me to some secondhand stores, and we bought me some clothes and proper clothes that they said to wear in an office. I put these clothes on. It was like Halloween. You know, look at the dirty Venice bride dressed in the citizen costume. And, you know, but I expected when I walk in for my interviews, they'd just offer me candy and send me out. But I kept going, you know, and I was sure I went on more interviews than anyone else in AA ever had, but I finally got a job. I was so excited. They called me in. I got a job in an insurance company. I knew my sponsor would be delighted. It was so square. And I went to work. I worked really hard, and on the seventh day, they called me in the office. I thought maybe they were going to give me a raise. And she said, "I'm sorry, dear. You don't have enough experience. We're going to have to fire you." And she said, "Not only that, you don't seem to have any common sense whatsoever." Now, I didn't know what that was, but I knew I was being insulted. And I went across the street. I called Los Angeles Central Office. I didn't have a car. And I said, "This is June G. I'm a sober member, and I've just been fired. What are you going to do about that?" And they just laughed. I couldn't believe it. I've been going to meetings for a couple years at that time. I had never heard of anybody sober in AA being fired, and I thought we would picket or something, you know. I couldn't believe we'd allow them to treat us like that. And I remember talking to my sponsor that night. I said, "You know, I never got fired before I came to AA." And he reminded me I'd never had a job. That hadn't even occurred to me. I was so outraged, you know. Anyway, I went ahead and I kept looking for a job. And about this time, I was making some of the amends in my life. And one of the amends I was making was for library book stealing. I had stolen, probably 30 to 50 library books during the years. Great classics like Misty the Seahorse, the things you steal when you're 6 and 7. And I had all of these books. I loaded them up. I took them down to the local librarian in Culver City. I explained to her I was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I gave her a copy of the big book and the 12 and 12 that I'd stolen. And I explained it was necessary for my sobriety to return the books and to make payments. I'd had some of the books for about 11 years, and they wanted 3 to 5 cents a day. So she said I could make payments. She said it was sort of funny, though. She said she'd worked in a library in Laguna Beach, California, and a man had come in with a book, the big book that he'd had for 37 years. And she says, "You guys must do this all the time." I went ahead and I kept on interviewing, and it certainly didn't help my self-confidence having been fired, but I went ahead and I tried. And one day this woman on the program, and I can't even remember exactly how this occurred, but she called me up and she said she knew a place she wanted to take me for an interview downtown L.A., and she took me to a bank. I'd never been in a bank in my life, and I thought it was pretty funny that a thief like me'd be even interviewing in a bank. But I went ahead and I filled out this application. I got to the part in the application where it says, "Due to the fact that as a bank employee it's necessary that you be bonded, we're going to do a thorough background check." And I thought, oh no, not me. I didn't want anybody looking into my past. I mean, they call one library and I've had it. And I didn't like that idea, but I thought about it and I thought, you know what, they told me, "Hey, I got to do the footwork and leave the results up to a higher power." And so that was one of the first times I consciously remember doing that. And I went ahead, I turned in the application, I got called back on a series of interviews, and I got hired. Not only did they hire me to work in the bank, they put me to work in the vault. And I didn't even know if AA worked that good, you know. But it did. I didn't steal anything the whole time I worked there. It was just amazing, you know. And while I was there, I decided to take a class at night at the local college so that I could get a driver's license. And things seemed to work out. I ended up getting laid off from that job, and I went ahead and I started to take a few more classes. I got offered a job on campus, and I started to go to school full-time and to work full-time. I had found a garage in Culver City at that time that I rented for $40 a month, and a bunch of people in AA had wanted to give me a lamp, and somebody else gave me a pillow, and somebody else gave me something else. I was wearing shoes by this time, and they required them at school, you know, and at the bank. Anyway, and I went ahead and I just went to school one day at a time. And I found out, I guess it was after about 3 years, They called me in the office at the school, and they told me that I'd completed the requirements for what they called an AA college degree. I thought that was a good name for a degree. I had never wanted a college degree in my life. You know, when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, if they said, would you like a switchblade or a college degree, I would have taken the switchblade. I didn't have any need for a college degree. But it was something that I could not believe had happened. You know, I had, in my life, I had gone to 15 grammar schools and 7 junior highs, and I had only finished 7th grade. I had never finished a semester at school, and I had never gone, from the time I had any control over it, which was about 6, Monday through Friday, without missing some period of time. Never. And during the 3 years that I was at that college, I never missed a day. I just sort of went there like Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what my sponsor told me to think about school. She told me to think about it as an AA request. And I was taught in Alcoholics Anonymous, if I said I'd be somewhere, I'd be there, I'd be on time, and I'd be dressed as well as I could, which usually meant I had to wear shoes. Anyway, and when they told me that I was graduating, they told me, you know, to get the cap and gown, and I went out there, and for the graduation ceremony, both of my sponsors were there, a couple sets of foster parents were there, my mother was there, and when I walked up to get my degree, they announced that I was graduating 3rd in my class out of 485 students, and when I used to stand at the door at the Tuesday night meeting welcoming the newcomers, somebody'd walk up and say, hi, I'm Kathy, and I'd say, hi, I'm June, and somebody'd walk up and say, hi, I'm Linda, and I'd say, hi, I'm Kathy, because after I heard more than 3 names, I could never remember which one was mine. And that's what I thought about that day, was I thought, how can this be possible? How could the kind of person that I was when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous have done this? It certainly wasn't me. I mean, I just sort of showed up, but it wasn't me. There's no way that June could have done what had happened. I knew Alcoholics Anonymous had made it possible. That's not to say that there weren't certain days when I began to think I was rather bright. But for the most part, I'm able to remember just how anything like that could ever have possibly happened. When I got to this program, I wasn't able to read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I couldn't read a whole sentence without losing my place. And here I was able to read in school the things that the teachers had required. I went ahead and I continued going to school. I graduated from college a couple years later. I had had a dream. I went ahead and did the footwork for that dream. And that's sort of how I was taught in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. My sponsors, I wouldn't say that they were not spiritual people, but they were very practical. And they told me that I could do anything I wanted to do here in Alcoholics Anonymous. That I could be anything I wanted to be. But I had to follow all the same steps as anyone else who had made it to that point. You know, that I couldn't sit at the AA club waiting for MGM to call me up and offer me a movie. You know, if I wanted to be an actress, I probably ought to take an acting class. And things like that. And so I went ahead and I did the footwork. And I turned in these applications and I received a telegram, I guess it's been a little over 6 years ago now, telling me that I had been accepted as one of 300 out of 3,000 applicants to go to law school. Now, I'll tell you, when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, I had always planned on spending a lot of time in court. But never on that side of the table. And it's absolutely impossible that I got into the law school that I got into. It just didn't happen. There were hardly any other dirty little Venice frauds there. I went to school there, and I learned a lot. Not just about the law and things like that. I learned a lot about Alcoholics Anonymous. I learned about what a special place I had been fortunate enough to spend a lot of my years growing up in, you know. And I had learned, you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous, there's such a lack of judgment that goes on here. That's not to say that we don't take each other's inventory once in a while just to help one another, of course. But for the most part, you know, the things that we talk about around here are things that most people would never disclose anywhere, and most of the time we're just sitting here laughing hysterically over them, you know. And I sort of found out that the sense of humor that I was given here in Alcoholics Anonymous is not necessarily shared by all. But it is mine, and I didn't have one when I came into this program, and I think it's probably the greatest gift I've ever been given. But I learned that it was a little warped when I was in law school. I remember, you know, going to school there. I was going to school with all these people who had, you know, they had mothers and fathers, you know, and they had, you know, grown up in nice homes. I tried not to hold it against them, but it wasn't easy all the time, you know. And a lot of times I just didn't feel like I was supposed to be there, you know, like I was as good as those people were or anything. And I sort of learned a lot about being one of God's kids, you know, that it had absolutely nothing to do with where I came from or where they came from, you know, that we were just all one of God's kids, and we'd all ended up there by different routes. But I remember one of the guys I was talking to, we were talking about a movie, and it was called The Rose. It was the story of Janis Joplin's life. And I was talking to this guy, and I couldn't believe he'd even heard of The Rose. You know, he was a very square guy from down behind the Orange Curtain in Orange County, California. And I was sure he wouldn't know anything about a rock singer like Janis Joplin, you know. And he said, yes, he said, you know, I saw that movie and I just loved it. He said, I've always idolized Janis Joplin. I was just shocked. And I said, really? And he said, yes. And he said, you know, there's this one thing about this movie that really bothered me. And I said, really, what was that? He said, well, there's this one part in the movie where Janis is about to have an affair with this man. And before she does, she says to him, I have a confession to make. When I was in high school, I slept with the entire high school football team. And this guy at law school says to me, he said, you know, if that's true about Janis, I just don't think I could ever respect her again. And I looked him right in the eye and I said, you mean you'd hold one football team against a girl? And this guy didn't sit next to me for 2 years. I didn't even go to high school, you know. I was scheduled to graduate in May of 1983. In the early part of 1983, I learned that my sponsor, Gail Wilson, was dying of cancer. She was 48 years old, and it was very sudden. It wasn't as sudden for her as it was for me, because Gail had known that she had cancer. She hadn't wanted me to know because she was afraid it would affect my studying. And I don't think any one single person ever changes our whole life, you know, but Gail had been one of the very important people in my life, and being my first sponsor and all. And I spent a lot of time with her in the hospital while she was dying. We spent a lot of time talking, of course, about AA, which was the most important thing in both of our lives. And while I would sit there, all these different doctors and nurses would come in to care for Gail, and while they would, she would insist on introducing me. She'd say, Dr. Smith, I want you to meet Junie. Junie's like a daughter to me. She's going to be an attorney. And I would think about it, you know, as she'd do this, these people had no interest in meeting me whatsoever, but I would think about it, you know, this is the same woman who used to say, don't sit next to me at the meeting, and don't tell anyone that I am your sponsor. And now she wanted to introduce me to strangers, you know. And what we talked a lot about was, you know, Gail told me, she said, you know, June, she said, when you asked me to be your sponsor, she said, I didn't want to say yes. I know it's hard for to believe, isn't it? But she said... She said, you know, I did it because that's the way I've been taught in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. But she said, I knew with your attitude and your background that you were going absolutely nowhere, you know. She said, I just knew it wasn't going to be able to work for someone like you. You were just too angry and too hostile, and so I just didn't think it would work. And she said, but I said yes anyway. And she said, and then I remember when you were a couple years sober and you told me you were going to take a class at school, and she said, I knew you'd never finish. You'd never finished anything. She said, but I didn't say anything to you. And so then I remember you hadn't been going to school for all that long, and you said, Gail, someday I want to go to law school and be a lawyer. And she said, I had to force myself not to laugh out loud, because she said, I knew that that couldn't happen, but I didn't tell you. And the thing was is that Gail never believed in June, never for 1 minute from the day that she first met me, but she always believed in Alcoholics Anonymous. So she never said I couldn't, or it was impossible, or things like that just don't happen. Because she knew that Alcoholics Anonymous makes things that just don't happen happen, and so she never said it. Gail passed away in April of 1983. I graduated from law school in May of 1983. I then studied for the bar exam, which, in case a lot of you don't know, and I didn't know this when I first started law school, in order to practice law, you have to pass a bar exam in whatever state you wish to practice. I studied for the California bar exam. I took that in July of 1983. The results were scheduled to come out in December of 1983. And I did for that test absolutely everything that was asked of me. I worked on it one day at a time. I tried to work on my spiritual condition. I tried to do everything that was asked of me in Alcoholics Anonymous. I did everything that those teachers asked of me. I gave it 100% of what I possibly could have given it. On December 1st, I got a telegram telling me that I did not pass the exam. And I absolutely could not believe it. I could not believe it. I was 10 years sober. I had enough money in my bank account to pay my rent, and that was it. I didn't have enough money to eat. I couldn't get a job because I hadn't passed that test. I didn't have money for gas. I didn't know what I was going to do, and I didn't want to do anything. I just wanted to stay home and cry. I felt like I'd let everyone down in Alcoholics Anonymous. I felt like I was a failure after 10 years of sobriety. And I had to share at a meeting that night. And I'll tell you, if there's any place I didn't want to be, it was sharing at a meeting. But the way I was taught in Alcoholics Anonymous is if I say I'll be there, I show up. And I showed up. I don't know what I said. I don't know whether they liked it. It didn't matter. I showed up, and after the meeting, I went out with two of my best friends. I didn't tell a whole lot of people right away that I didn't pass. I didn't talk to a whole lot of people. I just went to meetings, and I was very quiet, and I didn't talk about it very much, except for to my very closest friends. And after the meeting, I went out with these two people that I had that have been very important in my life, that I'd gotten sober with, and we talked about what this meant. And I explained to them what it meant. I knew what it meant. The reason I did not pass that test was because I was not supposed to be a lawyer. God wanted me to go back and be a waitress. And I knew that. I had known all through law school that God thought I should be a waitress. You know, it was just Gail and people like that that had gotten my expectations up to go. And they said to me, no, it meant that God wanted me to take the test again. And we had this terrible argument. You know, I know a lot of you probably had it with sponsors. You know how, like when you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, you call up your sponsor and you say, look, tomorrow is the first of the month, and my rent is due, and I don't have the money. And your sponsor says, go to a meeting. And you think, all right, maybe I said that too fast for him. So you say, look, okay, my manager is not in AA, all right, and my rent is due tomorrow. And they say, go to a meeting. It's sort of like if you ask somebody what time it is and they say, it's a horse. It's like you're not getting an answer. And that was one of those conversations that evening. I explained to them that I owed well over $20,000, you know, at this point, and I couldn't get a job. And they said, so borrow some more, you know. And it seemed to make perfect sense to them. And so I did it. What the hell? Might as well owe more. And so I began to study again for the test. And right about that time, I got a 12-step call from central office. And I remember I went over to pick this woman up, and this was just a few days after I found this out. And all I could do basically was just kind of cry. And went over and picked this woman up at a bar, and I brought her over to my house, and we were sitting there, and we were talking, and she started to cry. And she said, I just don't know how I'm going to pay my rent. And I said, neither do I. And she said, I don't have a job. And I said, neither do I. And she said, I just don't know what's going to happen to me. And I said, neither do I. And she said, how long have you been sober? I said, 10 and a half years. It's time to go to the meeting. Let's go. So I studied for the test. I gave it everything I could, just the way I had the first time. And I took it in February of 1984. I received a telegram in June of 1984 telling me that I had passed the exam. Now, I would love... I would love to be able to tell you that my spiritual program was equally strong for both of those telegrams. But it's just not true. Maybe in another 10 years or so. But I was so much more spiritually in tune when I got that telegram than I passed. I never felt closer to my higher power in my whole life. AA was great. It was just amazing, wasn't it? Anyway, I found out in that little packet that even after you pass the bar, you still can't practice. You have to be sworn in. It's really just another way of getting a couple hundred more dollars from you. So I borrowed that. What the hell? But in the little telegram, they said the swearing-in ceremony would be on June 13th. And that was D.L. Wilson's AA birthday. She would have been 21 years sober that day. And so sometimes I think maybe that's why I didn't pass it the first time. Maybe so I could celebrate my achievement in that respect with the woman that had had so much to do with it. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I have been given a life that I never could have had. You know, I used to hear Chuck C. talk a lot when I was new, and one of the things I remember him talking about, it just sort of stuck in my mind, was he used to say, if you go to work Monday through Friday, just waiting for the weekend and to get your paycheck, you're cheating yourself and everyone around you. And I would sit in meetings and afterwards sometimes and just think for hours, is he crazy? What other possible reason could there be for going to work except for to get your paycheck and to make more, you know? And today, in staying sober and in trying to work this program, I know a little bit more about what he's talking about. I try and look at my job, I try and get out there, and I try and be of service, you know, and that's just how I look at it. And I really, most of the time, I don't think about my paycheck. That's not to say that sometimes I don't. There are days when I go to work and I'm thinking about it all day long. But I find that the days that I'm the happiest, the days that work the best, the days that I'm the most successful at what I do, are the days when I'm just there to be of service and help God's kids. I love people in Alcoholics Anonymous. They're very, very special. But I don't think that we're the only ones of God's kids. You know, I think there's a lot of them out there that don't ever come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and they're God's kids too. And I think we're very fortunate that we have the program and the fellowship that we have. But there's a lot of people out there that have got things working for them too, and very special things. I've met some very special people out there in the world. I have a very special guy in my life. You know, and he's not in AA. Probably my first 10 years in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I felt sorry for everyone who wasn't in AA. I just pitied them, you know, because they had to be out there, not without this program. And I just don't feel like that today. I date this guy. He's absolutely wonderful. I mean, he's just he's nobody I ever would have dated in my life if he'd given me a choice. He doesn't have one tattoo, and he's never been to jail. He's a nice Jewish boy from Chicago that's the son of two doctors. And he's just not the kind of guy that I would have picked. You know, and we have a lot of fun. When we first began to date, we started to date in November, and in December he came home with two tickets to Chicago, where he's from, and he wanted to take me home and introduce me to his family, which are the most important people in his life. And I thought about when I went there, you know, I walked into that house, and I didn't for 1 minute think I wasn't good enough to be there. You know, I didn't think this is a nice place where nice people go and dirty little Venice broads shouldn't come here. I just kept thinking, isn't it amazing that Alcoholics Anonymous in about, oh, I don't know, I guess 8 or 9 years, whatever it was at that time, Alcoholics Anonymous had made something out of me that someone else was so proud of they wanted to introduce them to the most important people in their life. The same person that when I walked through doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, my own family and six others that I had visited as foster homes didn't want anything to do with me. When I was at a conference around 5 years sober, or maybe a little bit longer than that, I was, it was a Saturday night, it was the banquet, and I was sitting there comparing myself to everyone else in the room, as I still so frequently do, and looking at what they were wearing and what I was wearing. And I remember looking around and saying, you know, look at that green dress over there. Don't you wish you were wearing that green dress? And I said, no. I talked to myself, I'm glad I'm wearing this brown dress. And I thought, really? I said, yeah. Well, how about that black dress over there? Don't you wish you were wearing that? And I said, no, I'm glad I'm wearing this brown dress. Really? He's like, yeah. And I said, well, don't you wish you were blonde or stacked or anything? And I said, nope. And I thought, you're kidding. I thought, nope. I just want to have curly red hair and be tall and skinny and wearing a brown dress. And I realized for the very first time in my entire life, I wanted to feel like I was feeling. I absolutely could not believe it. And when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, there were some very persuasive people here. But I want to assure each and every one of you that there was not one or all of them put together that could have told me as I sat in those meetings, hoping that maybe the nausea would go away when I had to look in a mirror, that someday I'd be sitting somewhere wanting to look like me, wanting to feel like me, and wanting to be living my life, not anyone else's. I just couldn't have believed it could ever be possible. I want to tell you one other story, and then I'm going to sit down. First of all, I, in case I forgot to mention it, I frequently leave my mother out there drinking. My mother is sober today, and she celebrated 9 years of sobriety in December, and She has a bumper sticker on her car that says, "My daughter is a winner." And that's not the same sticker she would have had when I came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to just tell you about one of the special lessons I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, not to mean that I don't need to learn it time and time again, but when I was a couple of years sober, I got emotionally involved with the guy. And when we were dating, I didn't really work on a relationship with a higher power, because I always thought that you should either have a boyfriend or a higher power. I never really thought you should have both. It just seemed sort of selfish. I thought God was for the single women. And so, since I had a boyfriend, I wasn't really working on that aspect of any kind of a program or anything. And one day at a time, he left me. And being the kind of person that I was, drinking the way that I did, I didn't even start to have feelings for other people. You know, I didn't even get close to having feelings. I just took things and stayed as far away from people emotionally as I could. And this hurt. I had never been rejected because I'd never taken a chance. And as I sat there that day and I started to feel those feelings that all of us have felt, and never thinking that I would ever feel them and never knowing what to do with those feelings, I decided that AA wouldn't work. I decided that there was no way I could survive this kind of pain sober. And there was no way that I wanted to go back out there and drink and live the life that I had lived. And that left me the one alternative, the same one I'd had since I was 5 years old. It meant I had to kill myself. And as I sat there realizing that I would have to kill myself, that AA couldn't work, I was about 2 years sober, there was a knock at my door. And this guy named Bob was standing there, and I said, "How you doing, Bob?" And he said, "Listen, do you remember? You said you'd go over to this high school with me. We were going to go for central office and tell him a little bit about AA. And you said you'd go a couple weeks ago." And I said, "Gee, Bob." I said, "I don't really have any experience, strength, and hope. I was just going to go in the bathroom and kill myself." And he said, "Well, have you had dinner?" And I said, "No." And he said, "I'll tell you what, why don't we go, we'll get something to eat, we'll go over to the meeting at the school, you know, I'll talk, you don't have to say anything, and then afterwards I'll bring you home and you can kill yourself." And I said, "Okay." So we went along, and now you have to understand that I'm the kind of person, when I don't feel good, you know, when I'm in a lot of pain, I don't like to talk to people. You know, I like to just sit there and think things through by myself. Now, that's one of the reasons my sponsors have told me I've never yet had a problem that's been as bad as my solution for it. But I always believe that I should do it myself, you know. And so as we were driving, I wasn't talking to Bob. I was just sort of thinking things through. I was thinking about the fact that not only had this guy left, but there would never be anyone else. And if you don't concentrate on that, you might miss some of the pain that's involved in those kind of thoughts. So I was deeply in thought. And we got to the high school, and we were walking over to the classroom, and this woman came up to me and said, "Excuse me, do you know where room 213 is?" And I said, "No." And she said, "Well, could you help me find it?" I thought, "I'll probably lose my place here, but I can hopefully get back to it." So I took her around the school. I got her lost. As we were walking around, she said, "What kind of class are you taking here tonight?" And I said, "I'm not really taking a class. I came here with some friends. We were going to talk a little bit about alcoholism." She said, "Really? For it or against it?" I said, "Well, I guess you'd say against it. I've never really heard of any talks for alcoholism." And she said, "Really?" She said, "I'm on the wagon." And I said, "Well, that's great." I said, "I've known a lot of people on the wagon. Most of them fall off, but if that's working for you, that's wonderful." And she said, "Well, why would you give that kind of a talk?" And I said, "I'm an alcoholic. And I stay sober one day at a time through a program called Alcoholics Anonymous. Would you like to go to a meeting sometime?" And she said, yes, she would. And we traded phone numbers and made arrangements to go to a meeting the next night. Obviously, I couldn't go home and kill myself. She'd think AA didn't work. And so I took Kay to lots and lots of meetings. And Kay didn't stay sober at that time, but I did. Kay came back. She just had 10 years in August. But I learned something very special. I learned just what it says in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, in the chapter Working with Others, in the very beginning. It says, when all else fails, try working with another alcoholic. Now, I'm the kind of person, when all else fails, all I can think about is, it's all failing. Why is it all failing? You know, but fortunately for me, my higher power has always somehow put someone like that in my life so that I can get through those times when all else fails. And for anyone who's here tonight, who's new or who's been around for a long time, if you happen to be in one of those long, dark hallways, please don't give up before the miracle happens in your life. I have absolutely no idea what it's going to be for you, just as I've had no idea what they were going to be for me or what they are going to be. But it's definitely worth waiting for. Hollis, Marie, thank you so much for inviting me.